This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about OCD and confidence with Kate Lucas. She's a musician and comedian who I'm a big fan of. In particular, how she works her music into a comedy narrative as part of her performances. So she'll have some jokes and some stand-up, and there's often a kind of message to it. And then to kind of really punch the point home, she'll then finish up with a song on each kind of topic. She did a show this year in Edinburgh called Kate Lucas is Selling Herself, which was very much themed around the digital age and the pressure to constantly kind of self-promote on social media, particularly when you have a career like hers, which requires ticket selling. And some of her conflicts around that, as we'll talk about in the episode, having to come across confident and self-assured and be really good at selling herself, even though she often doesn't feel that way. So it's really interesting as another example of us getting kind of behind the scenes of what it's like for someone that performs and is known to most people that come across them as this, you know, bubbly, outgoing performer on a stage. And in that, a sort of authority in a way, an authority you might assume on confidence. And yet off stage, it's something she's had a much more up and down journey with.
Yeah. I think it goes to show, though, Bobby, how, as we do talk about a lot, any term that we coin or we phrase, you know, confidence, what it means to her, to me, to you, to anybody, is all subjective. Mm. Because you're absolutely right. There's millions of people that would look at her and think, you are so confident, you're more confident than me, because I wouldn't get up on stage and do that. Mm-hmm. But for Kate and any performer, I suppose when you're around other people who perform and do what you do all the time, you then measure your confidence against their confidence. And however you choose to think about whether or not you're confident is whatever you put on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very relative. And that's why it's, in a way, a theme that I really wanted to cover relating to mental health, because that relationship is so close, but it's not always linear. Instead, it's more a case of the confidence relative to each situation and whether you feel able to perform in it. So if you're confident performing on stage, then that's absolutely fine. But if there's other areas of your life that your kind of outlook is holding you back, that's potentially when you've got more of those vulnerabilities that something like an anxiety condition like OCD could potentially be creeping in or could be exacerbated by you feeling out of place and therefore more anxious in certain situations.
Yeah.
And so confidence, I think, is intrinsically linked to that, but at times in quite a nuanced way.
Yeah, well, which is why we should have more opportunity for people to explore more things at school and growing up. And a lot of our guests that we've had on previously, including Kate, talk about bullying and things that happen during school, because in certain situations, then you are not confident. It exacerbates your mental illness or whatever it is you're going through, because you're in an environment that just doesn't suit you and doesn't bring out your confidence. But if 70% of school was maybe performing with a guitar and singing a song, maybe others wouldn't have fit in and Kate's confidence would have blossomed. You know, we have that absolute responsibility to have our young people and children being able to, you know, get me on my rant, to be able to explore themselves and whatever it is that they're potentially good at or enjoy during their whole school years, not just put into this box. And then if they don't fit in that, then they get bullied or that they have problems and then they get anxious about that and other illnesses start creeping in.
And none of this is to say that you have to be confident in everything, but it's relevant only to your life and what you're going through.
Absolutely.
And whether you feel able and prepared and have a high enough opinion of yourself for the situations you find yourself in.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of the crossover is. Another thing, in terms of researching for this, the synonym that kept cropping up attached to the research wasn't confidence, but was instead self-esteem. That maybe that to many people sounds like a more formal way of describing confidence in relation to a kind of personal progression or our mental health. So I got a definition of self-esteem from the NHS, which is, self-esteem is the opinion we have of ourselves. When we have healthy self-esteem, we tend to feel positive about ourselves and about life in general. It makes us feel better able to deal with life's ups and downs. When our self-esteem is low, we tend to see ourselves and our life as more negative and in a critical light. We also feel less able to take on the challenges life throws at us. So I thought that was a really clear way of explaining that. And they also then go on to talk a little bit about what causes low self-esteem. So I'll read from that as well. Low self-esteem often begins in childhood. Teachers, friends, siblings, parents, and even the media send us messages about ourselves, both positive and negative. For some reason, the message that you aren't good enough is the one that stays with you. Perhaps you found it difficult to live up to other people's expectations of you, or to your own expectations. Stress and difficult life events, such as serious illness or bereavement, can also have a negative effect on self-esteem. Personality can also play a part. Some people are just more prone to negative thinking, whilst others set impossibly high standards for themselves. What do you reckon to that?
Yeah, I think self-esteem is probably a better, it's almost a precursor actually of confidence. You could have a decent level of self-esteem, which might just allow you to step into situations that you're unsure of, where confidence then might come from that, to step into situations or to deal with challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why in researching this, there was far more frequently findable links between self-esteem and mental health, because whilst they're quite similar terms, self-esteem is more usually used to refer to the feelings internally relating to who you are, as opposed to confidence being how you feel in relation to external things and situations.
Yeah.
So in the episode, of course, we're talking a lot about confidence, but they are very closely linked. Mm. And I guess the takeaway would be, in terms of us saying earlier, you don't have to be confident in everything, but self-esteem is something to prioritize more potentially.
Yeah.
That a high level of self-esteem will increase your resilience, will potentially, as the NHS described there, shield you in parts from certain life challenges in a way that confidence will as well, but it's a lot more situational.
Absolutely.
So hopefully that makes sense. So you don't have to be confident in everything, but having good self-esteem is very important. And to link back to OCD, the co-theme of this episode, we have a stat on prevalence from OCD UK. Obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, is a serious anxiety condition that affects 1.2% of the population, which is around 750,000 people here in the UK, based on current estimates. So we've talked about the prevalence of OCD several times when covering it before, but it is worth, I think, setting that tone, that it is a condition that's a lot more common than a lot of people realise. 750,000 people. And like many conditions, OCD can be one that's diagnosed later in life. There can be easier labels that people get younger, or as their symptoms are still developing, into the more specific OCD as opposed to general anxiety symptoms. One other thing I'm really keen to mention in terms of confidence and OCD is, to me, there's really clear crossover with that condition and this factor in particular. So when we've covered OCD in the past, confidence has come up as part of that you've got this negative chatter grinding away in your brain, and it can really distort how you feel about yourself. Yeah. If you've got all these negative, dark thoughts coming out, it can really affect your view of yourself and make you question even if you're a good person, and that it's part of you and not an illness that's affecting you.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's something that's come up a lot when we've talked about OCD. So I'm really glad to cover this particular combination. And I think that will really come through in the interview with Kate, how one affects the other so frequently.
And generally people know, don't they, that there's an irrationality to it. So that will affect your self-esteem and therefore your confidence. Thinking, why am I thinking like this? I know that it's irrational. I know that these thoughts aren't coming true when you're having maybe a good day.
For sure, it would naturally lead to a lot of questioning of, why am I like this?
Mm.
So I was really interested to discuss this at more depth with Kate. One last thing I wanted to mention, which was a study I read about a little while ago and then had a real challenge trying to find again. I slightly thought I'd made it up, but I have found this referenced with Scientific America. And there was a study into how confidence and self-esteem are influenced by the ways in which we talk about ourselves out loud. And they found these surprising benefits of sarcasm, as the researchers describe it, so that there was a quite obvious link between people being very derogatory about themselves. You know, I feel like we all know that one friend that constantly puts themselves down.
Yeah.
And you say something nice to them and they find a way to turn it into a negative. And it can be very hard to hear if you care about that person. There was an obvious link there that you keep talking about yourself negatively, you're reinforcing that belief in yourself. Because in a way, by speaking about it, you're making it more real and concrete. Sort of trying to bring other people on board with this negative set of beliefs. Then, by contrast, people that are constantly talking about how great they are tend to be the people that believe they're great.
Yeah.
But what was really key from this study was that they found sarcasm switched that across. It sort of flipped the script on it. So people that said nice things about themselves sarcastically were found to have higher levels of self-esteem. And even in the study, they noticed a difference where people would be encouraged to talk about themselves in one of these three ways. And they measured afterwards how confident the person felt before and after.
Oh, wow.
And so it had an incredibly immediate effect in many cases that people being sarcastic when saying positive things about themselves actually boosted their confidence and their self-esteem.
Oh.
And it's a tricky one that more research is definitely needed as to why that link is. Is it a case of the sarcasm is kind of secondary to whether or not it's a positive or a negative and therefore has less of an impact? Or could it be that in a way it's a kind of coping mechanism? If you're sort of humorous in a way about your self-deprecation, then that's not as bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I interviewed people for their comedy and mental health miniseries in August, we kept coming back to this thing of people performing comedy and the therapeutic benefits they found from that. And I wonder if this is potentially linked.
Yeah.
That by finding a way to have humour around some of their darkest times, it shifted the narrative to a more positive one.
Yeah.
Even if they might still be making a joke out of it, or they might still be sarcastic about it, it's still a more positive, productive way of storytelling, perhaps.
Yeah, it's really interesting to look into that further. That is probably because ultimately, whether you're saying it in a comedy way, a sarcastic way, whatever, you're doing it, you're talking about it. So does that already just give you a next level of self-esteem or confidence? Because you're actually one of those that is actually talking about it. And that is a massive step forward anyway.
Yeah, potentially a sort of owning your narrative situation.
Yeah, Bobby, you go there. Own your narrative. That's a better, that's a better way to say it.
I love
it.
Owning my narrative.
Yeah, own your narrative.
That's why I have a podcast.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So on that note, we'll get into the interview shortly. One more thing we need to mention is that the podcast has been doing incredibly well.
I was wondering if you were going to bring it up.
It's been doing really, really well through October. We've had World Mental Health Day, which has brought a lot of interest.
Yeah.
We won our first ever podcast award. And as of recording this, we're currently featured with Apple Podcasts and have reached 7th on the health and fitness charts. So we're a little bit blown away.
Yay.
It's still
Thank you, everybody.
It's still kind of settling in how much our listenership has grown. So I wanted to pause and acknowledge that. So welcome if you're new. Hopefully in intros like this, you'll get to know Danielle and I a bit better. And if it's your first ever episode, double welcome. I hope you enjoy it.
Mm.
The only other thing I'd say is if you are new and you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, please do consider leaving us a 5-star review. You don't actually have to write a review. You can just tap on the stars and give a rating if you don't want to. But that will really help us stay at this new level of popularity and destigmatize mental health for as many people as we can.
Brilliant.
So with all that said, we are going to continue with our day in our very good mood. In the meantime, please enjoy this interview with the brilliant Kate Lucas. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
My name is Kate Lucas. I don't know when I first became aware of mental health.
Was it something that was ever kind of talked about at home? Were you aware of like the term mental health or like common mental illnesses?
Not really, not more than anybody else. I mean, most people have heard of depression, but in terms of other things, no, not really. I didn't get any kind of insight until I was in my 20s, I think. And I just randomly stumbled on an article online. But otherwise, it's just, I think because depression is so common and widespread, most people know somebody who's experienced it. And it's quite easy to define what that is. Everyone's heard of it. But in terms of other mental health issues, they're not talked about quite as much.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even within that, there's a kind of level of it that people understand maybe depression and also anxiety in a general sense, as if they're just an emotion and not a whole full-blown illness that can be very severe. And so when you saw this article, what kind of caught your eye about it?
It was about OCD, and like everybody else, I kind of thought OCD was just about keeping things clean and being a little bit uptight and overly organised, which it's not at all. I mean, sometimes that's what people are anxious about within OCD, is germs or... But the whole idea is that this anxiety of needing to fix something or have an answer to something and not being able to tolerate any element of kind of doubt and just fixating on it. So is that straight? I'm not sure. I have to make sure that it is. I have to go back and check that it's straight. And it's the checking and the anxiety that are kind of OCD more than the subject of it. Sometimes it's cleaning for people. Sometimes it's all sorts of things.
that's a really great distinction there, because it's right. It's about the anxiety behind the thing. It's not a behavioural condition where it's like, oh, some people do things this way.
Yes.
Those compulsions are to alleviate the anxiety.
Yeah.
And that's the core of the mental illness.
Yeah. And the first time I'd read about it in any other terms than just somebody who's neat and tidy was some random article online. I think it was in The Guardian or something that I stumbled across and just burst into tears because I went, that's me. And I'd never really had an answer for my kind of thoughts and behaviour when I was growing up. I went through a really rough phase and then went to the doctors, got referred for a kind of mental health assessment. I was on a waiting list, and by the time I got a letter through, I was only like 16, like I said, and I got this letter through saying, I'd like to invite Kate to so-and-so hospital at so-and-so time. These colleagues will perform the assessment. And I was like, oh my God, that sounds so scary. It sounds like, oh, we're just going to check that you're not a psycho. Do you know what I mean? I know that's not a very nice word to use, but
yeah,
when you were a teenager.
To be fair, if I had that and multiple people were mentioned who would be assessing my mind, I would be expecting to...
It felt like you will pass or fail sanity. That's what it felt like to me. Not we'll figure out what's making you think these thoughts and help you find a way around it. It was, let's find out if you're normal or not. We're worried that you're not. That's how it felt to me. And so I didn't go because it freaked me out.
What happened then?
Like I said, it was when I was about 16, and it was, I think, during like summer holidays. So I'd spent a lot of time on my own and in my own head and not wanting to go and hang out with people. And then I ended up going back to school, but it would have been sixth form at the time. So I think because that was new and I was taking myself out of my head for a bit, I sort of got vaguely better on my own.
You had enough distraction, seemingly.
Yeah, exactly. And then, I don't know, I think it's something that's just kind of always humming away in the background, but like anything else, just when you're feeling a bit stressed or vulnerable, it can sort of drag you under a little bit again.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a few different phases of that throughout my 20s.
And were you noticing that from quite a young age? You saw that kind of correlation of when I'm not at my best, well, then this thing also gets worse, and that kind of vicious cycle?
Kind of. I didn't really know, like I said, what it was mm-hmm. until I read some article in my 20s. So I think at the time when I went to the doctors, they kind of said, yeah, it sounds like maybe you're depressed. And I thought, but that doesn't really explain some of what I'm feeling and what's going on.
Yeah. And that's often the case that people are misdiagnosed, because there's some symptoms that are more obvious. And so it's kind of jumped on those of, okay, we know you've got something, so we're just going to pin this one in for now.
Yeah, it just feels like, oh, something's gone a bit wrong in your head. Yeah. It must be depression, because that's a nice big umbrella that covers a lot. And I really wish, actually, that I'd gone to that appointment when I was younger. But I thought, well, I feel better now, and just reading that has upset me and made me feel like I'm crazy. So I just didn't want to go, and I didn't want to make myself vulnerable again. I just wanted to kind of shut it out and carry on. But maybe if I'd gone at the time, they would have been able to explain to me lots of things that I didn't understand until later.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense, particularly with OCD being the umbrella of anxiety conditions or any kind of letter like that that seems so formal and out of what you're used to is going to trigger the same symptoms.
Yeah, it's so difficult, because sometimes you really want to criticise the way that it's handled, and I definitely will do that when it comes to the NHS and as an adult trying to get help. You've also got to accept that you are seeing things from a hypersensitive perspective, and some people are just doing their best. So, you know, why would you know when you type up a letter like that, that that's going to have that effect on somebody?
Although you'd hope if anyone does, it's the medical professionals there to deal with that.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. They don't know pre-assessment what you're dealing with. And so they can't, unfortunately, please every possible variation of a human.
Yeah, and to them that's not an offensive term, assessment, but to me it was, oh my god, I'm crazy. Mm-hmm. They're checking if I'm crazy.
And so that worry almost sounds like, what if they find out? Where did that go?
Yeah, I just didn't look at the letter again and didn't go to the appointment, and that was that.
Mm-hmm.
I just needed to kind of shut it out and pretend it hadn't happened, and which was silly, but that's how I felt at the time.
Yeah, it's completely understandable. And so with our theme today being confidence, what was your confidence like when you were at school at that age?
I've always been a sort of mixture of introvert and extrovert. So I always did drama and things like that. But in some ways I was probably more confident than other kids, but in other ways I would internalise things a lot and worry more than other kids. So yeah, I once, like a couple of times in school, got called a prima donna and once got called arrogant. And because of the way I overthink things, that just upset me so much that I went completely into my shell and thought, oh, everyone thinks so about myself and blah, blah, blah. And I really regret being that kind of weak about it, because you realise, as long as you're not thinking that you're above everybody else, actually there's nothing wrong with being confident. And if you take someone's confidence away from them, you really hold them back in life quite a lot. And I felt like I really went into my shell for a long time. My parents kind of noticed it and said it's such a shame, because the stuff that I would have thought I was able to do, I kind of went, oh, I can't do that, and I shouldn't push myself forward, and I shouldn't show off, or I shouldn't, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you kind of learn through your own feelings to hide from anything kind of new or potentially scary.
Yeah, and I was scared of being judged by people. I think the OCD element was just, I'd hear a criticism and fixate on it. And oftentimes it was just because I was making a joke in class and just trying to be funny, sometimes successfully, and that pissed the teachers off. But I was never trying to be better than anybody else or trying to be, you know?
Yeah, you were just figuring out who you were
as
a young person. We know now, I think looking back, that there was that performative element of who you are. And so you were exploring that in the same way the kid that was really well-behaved was exploring their academia.
Yeah.
It was just coming out in different ways.
Yeah.
But you've highlighted there as well an interesting irony with OCD, in that, like many anxiety-related conditions, it can make you so much more sensitive to the perceptions of others.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Being kind of almost ready for that criticism of like, who's going to tell me what they really think of me?
Yeah, yeah.
And yet the irony is people experiencing symptoms like that are often far nicer because they're really going out of their way to not defend and to get along with everyone.
Yeah. You know, I never wanted to be nasty to anybody or above anybody. Like I read a review up here that wasn't great and kind of burst into tears. And it's hard to have high self-esteem if you've got something that essentially makes you doubt and question everything. So rather than hearing, oh, that person didn't like that line, maybe I could do that better in future. That's what your logical brain does. But the rest of you goes, and everyone's always thought you were an idiot, and everyone thinks you're stupid, and everyone thinks this, and people think this, and you're this, and blah, 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 blah. And it just goes on and on and on in your head. And you can see, like, you could float above yourself. You just go, you're being completely illogical, but you can't help it.
Yeah, because you're so in the feelings. And for you at that time, your coping mechanism was the compulsions.
Mm.
And so what kind of compulsions were you doing?
In terms of periods when I've been really bugged by a particular obsession, lots of it was just confessing and having to, so if I was having unpleasant thoughts about a person, I would have to tell the person to check that they still liked me and still thought I was okay, which is obviously awkward as fuck, because if you're telling someone, oh, I had this really unpleasant thought about you, they're like, well, thanks for that. why would you tell me that? And it's like you want to check that they don't hate you, which seems like a really selfish thing, but it's just there's this anxiety in your head that if I don't get this person's approval or forgiveness, then I don't know what I'll do with myself.
Yeah, I don't think that's selfish so much, because you're worried about those interpersonal relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. It always attaches itself to the people that you care the most about, which is frustrating as hell. If it was someone you couldn't stand, you go, well, yeah, I'll fixate on that person for a bit and move on. I don't particularly like them or care what they think, but it's always somebody that you do care about, and that's why it causes you so much anxiety.
Yeah, and I think for you with the work you do as well, you've got an additional layer of being invested in how strangers view you as well, because that influences your career and how you do. And
yeah,
I think that's a real misconception, that you see someone up on a stage and as an audience member it doesn't seem that vulnerable because they're dressed up looking their best and they're presenting work they've been working on and really the best side of them that they can.
Yeah.
And yet it's incredibly vulnerable because you're saying, okay, this is the very best of me. Please don't hate it.
Yeah. I always think of it like, you know, when you have a conversation and you think, you go over it in your head afterwards, like an argument, and you think, God, I wish I'd said this or I wish I'd said that. When you're on stage, you've already pre-prepared your best comeback or your best thing that you could say to make you look the best version of you. So it's actually more comfortable sometimes to go up and do that than it is to be in the moment with somebody. Like, I find it probably more comfortable being on stage talking to strangers than I do meeting a new person one-on-one.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
My sister feels the same. Like, she's not on stage or anything, but she feels much more comfortable in a group of people just chipping in when she's got something funny to say or something she feels like saying, and then taking a step back. But one-on-ones freak her out, and I feel the same way.
Really?
Yeah, you just feel like, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm very opposite to that, which I guess makes sense, me being an interviewer. But no, I love one-to-one because I think for me, then I only have to focus on one person.
Yeah.
Whereas I think growing up, and maybe this is partly the way I am, I was always a quite out there alternative child.
Yeah.
So perhaps that was more conducive to having individual relationships and fitting myself into that rather than trying to please a whole group of people with different opinions of me.
Yeah.
Even today, I think that would still stress me out more.
Oh, really?
Being able to, communicate one-on-one. That's definitely my preference.
Oh, no, I prefer a group. I like the kind of way that the conversation ticks along. There's no pressure. You don't have to fill a silence. Someone else can fill it.
It's interesting. I wonder if it's maybe partly a introvert-extrovert thing as well. I'm very extroverted.
Yeah.
So I love meeting new people and really getting to know them.
Yeah.
And so interviewing suits me perfectly because I get to meet people for the first time and then get chatting to them about really interesting stuff. straight away. And I guess in a group, you have to keep it more lighthearted and jovial, which I don't really think is real.
I don't know. Friends of mine do tend to want to get to the nitty gritty with each other.
That's good.
I kind of know all about the dark recesses of all my friends' minds. I think they're just naturally more open and want to talk about it. So, yeah, I just still prefer being in a group.
I've forgotten what my train of thought was.
No,
because it was good stuff. Okay, I know what I'm going to say. But what we've talked about there is really key, I think, how confidence can be so situational.
Mm.
That seemingly you being up on stage, I would say to most people, sounds really scary. And yet you've found a comfort in doing that.
I think now, when you first do it, it's terrifying. Most people don't go, right, I'm going to go and do a stand-up comedy gig and I assume I'll be hilarious. Most people are like, what am I doing? Why have I done this? Oh my God, what if nobody laughs? Blah, 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 blah. But yeah, once you kind of get used to it and you do get laughs and you're repeating the same set again for a while and it's bedded in your head, then it becomes, once you're up there and you've said the first few lines, it becomes quite comfortable. Unless you have a reviewer in, in which case it becomes terrifying again. It just makes you nervous because you feel like you're being judged and it's scary.
Yeah, and then it can potentially throw the conditions of it in a way then, because you're partly performing to this reviewer, and does that change how you perform?
Yeah, definitely. Sometimes you'll have a great gig where you just feel like you are in the moment and there's no outside eye on yourself. And sometimes you have a gig where you're watching yourself going, well, you sound like a monotone idiot, or you forgot that bit, you're going to forget this bit, blah, 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 blah. That's so unhelpful, and that always happens when there's a reviewer and you just get... because you try and view it from their point of view, because you're trying to anticipate what they're going to say about you. So basically you get your inner critic in your head to give you a terrible review while someone's reviewing you and while you're trying to perform it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, some days you feel ready for it and ready for the attack and you just go, right, screw it, I'm just going to be in the moment and do my best job and go for it. But some days you're just, floating above your own head, criticising yourself.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear how much it varies for you, because I think there's this assumption for people outside of the industry that you kind of reach a point and you're just then a professional, and so you just have a routine and a kind of, five things you do before you go on stage, and you're just kind of polished even in how you approach comedy. But the way you describe it, it sounds a lot more like it's constantly evolving.
Well, because no two audiences are ever going to be the same, you can't go and do the same thing to every different audience and get the same reaction. You're always performing to a different group of people. So even if you've built up a level of confidence and you've got like a strong fan base and you're Michael McIntyre or whoever, you'll still one day go out and just unexplainably die on your ass. There's nobody who doesn't happen to. So it kind of keeps you on your toes all the time. And you do have to monitor it and make sure. Because it freaks you out, especially if you've been used to doing well for a while and you suddenly have a bad gig. You just go, what? What the hell have I done wrong? You become really critical of yourself and try and figure out what you did.
Yeah, and I'm sure that can really clash with the ego that some people can develop with success. That they somehow start to see themselves as impenetrable.
Yeah.
But you can always write a bad joke. Doesn't matter who you are.
Yeah, yeah. Trust me. That's really possible.
And so I'm interested to know how that evolution happened, where you were at school and in part due to the OCD symptoms you were experiencing, to then that becoming your work.
So whenever it came to a situation where I had to kind of prove myself to a specific person, then I would get, I felt like held back by my confidence. But I always performed throughout school and uni and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then in uni I got told that I was good, but I needed to be more confident. So then there was a module in stand-up comedy and I took it because I thought, okay, well, if I do something that's really scary, then I'll feel more brave and more bulletproof, I guess. And so I tried it, and then it's just a whole roller coaster of its own.
Mm-hmm. Could you share a little bit more of that roller coaster?
So you start out just terrified, and you actually manage to get on stage and do it, and it's amazing. then you have your first death, and that feels like the worst thing in the world that's impossible to get over. You spend a really long time developing a thick skin with it, or trying to. It really took me a long time to be able to honestly say that I can have a bad gig and just go, that's a shame, but it's not the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
That took quite a few years, I reckon. And then, yeah.
What do you think built that up?
Yeah, I just think, it's the same as any talking about OCD and obsessions and stuff. Eventually it burns itself out because you can't sustain that level of anxiety throughout the whole of your life. You'll be obsessed with a particular thing. You won't be able to stop thinking about it morning, noon and night. And it takes over everything. But then eventually your body's just exhausted and it moves on because nobody can be that anxious forever. So it's kind of, if you keep repeating the same thing with comedy, you can't maintain that level of nervousness throughout all of that time. I'm sure I lost weight when I started doing comedy just through diarrhea, through sheer fear of performing. And then you can't sustain that forever. So you eventually plateau and go, actually, this is okay. I'm not going to die. Everything's fine.
That makes a lot of sense. It's kind of soberingly reassuring this can't continue forever.
Yeah, well, I think so. Genuinely, in terms of mental health, no state's going to continue forever, I don't think. Mm-hmm. There's always some kind of light.
Yeah. And amongst you developing in your career and growing in confidence in that way, were you getting any support alongside that with your OCD?
So it's really hard. If you go to your GP, they're only allowed to see you for a certain amount of time and you don't necessarily know what symptoms to mention.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know specifically what to say to them to get to speak to the right people. Yeah, or I don't want to be asking for more help than I deserve.
Yeah.
Maybe there are people who feel more bad than me. Maybe I'm, so many stupid disorders and mechanisms could stop you from answering that correctly. Yeah.
And a lot of them are quite universal.
Yeah. At the time, I was definitely not in a good place and was like suicidal for a little bit. And you need to be there before anyone's going to help you. But they don't realise that these things are ongoing and they can be a really small voice in the back of your head that makes day-to-day life just harder than it should be, or they can be a massive, roaring, I'm going to ruin your life kind of a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't really matter at what stage you realise that voice is there and how loud that voice is at the time.
And it can feel like that. It can feel like you're punished for being high-functioning.
Yeah.
And, I'm lucky to be in a position where I have private counselling at the moment, and I wonder if I went to the NHS today and said, oh, run out of money, need to get some counselling with you guys.
Yeah.
I wonder what priority level I'd be, because I've had so much support and I am high functioning. That doesn't mean I don't need support, but I probably wouldn't need support compared to everyone else they see that day, or at least most of them.
Yeah.
And that's quite scary to think about.
Yeah.
That you have to be ill enough to get the help. It's not enough to just be ill.
Yeah.
And that's quite a weird situation.
I understand that people need to be triaged. And it's like if I went into A&E with a broken thumb and someone went into A&E just coming out of a car crash, of course, see them first.
Mm-hmm.
It's because there isn't the funding. And the experiences that you do have when you really are in a desperate situation stay with you for the whole of your life. The period when I was a teenager and things were really not good, I could still talk about that to someone and burst into tears. It's still like really
raw.
Yeah. And I never got an explanation for that at the time.
Yeah. And that stays with you because that's a part of your past, and it creates a trauma in and of itself that you can't fix in hindsight.
Mm.
As much as things like counselling can help a lot to kind of untangle the past, that still happened and that still will never be right.
Yeah. Which is like, that's life and that happens and that's okay. I sort of went through another really tough phase when I was in my 20s when I initially went to the doctor and then anyone outside of my GP.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time they were saying, so what symptoms are you having every day? And I was not in the middle of this particular obsession that I had at the time because I'd sort of just reached the end of it. At the time I actually asked for help, I was, and I still wanted answers to that.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point, because it does vary, and it varies from day to day.
Yeah, so, and because you know how awful it is sometimes to just feel completely sucked under, you don't want to overplay it when you don't feel that low. So if somebody says, do you feel low 4 times a week or whatever, you think, well, I don't feel as low as I did during that horrible period, so am I allowed to say that I feel low? Probably not, because it's not as bad as that.
Yeah, the worse you get, the higher the bar goes for how bad you think you have to feel.
Yeah.
To be worthy of the support.
Yeah.
And that's something I remind GPs when I speak to them, that nobody wants to go to you on their worst day. And most people don't want to go to you at all. You know, so where possible, we're going to try and schedule in for a day when we're going to be a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's worth noting. And the second thing I like to mention is how with mental health, in a way that's just not replicated with physical health, there's so much pressure on the patient to be an expert on them.
Yeah.
And particularly when dealing with conditions that affect how we think, thinking through objective opinions on how we're feeling just doesn't add up. How are we going to be an expert at that?
Yeah, it's like, tell me what's wrong with you and I'll tell you if you're right or wrong. And it's like, I don't know what's wrong with me, that's why I'm here. Yeah, I needed someone to talk through it with me.
Yeah, absolutely. And someone that's an expert, because the alternative is all the pressure is on you to educate yourself. Even if you do get a diagnosis, often it's briefly explained because of these time constraints.
Yeah.
And then you've got to go back and Google OCD, and who knows the reliability of which website you end up on.
Yeah, exactly. Because by the time I actually did speak to someone who was actually trying to give a diagnosis, some of the questions he asked me, I was just thinking, again, what's the right answer to this? Not what's the actual answer. Instantly, five things enter your head and you think, which one of these should I say? Which ones am I allowed to say? Which ones are correct? Blah, 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 blah. And obviously that must be really hard for them to, they don't know what's going on in your head. They have to rely on what you tell them. But because you get so little time, you just kind of want to crawl into a ball when you get in there.
And I imagine all that you'd experienced had really contributed to struggling with confidence. And then that same difficulties with confidence is affecting how you articulate yourself, how you're coming across in the room.
Yeah, because you question absolutely everything that comes out of your mouth and think, you start to say something and already you're going, no, that sounds like you think this, and you don't, so don't say that. And, you know, you don't know the right thing to say. It's just a stressful situation. And I don't know what the answer is in terms of, you know, if there aren't enough trained people and there isn't enough time, the situation is what it is and you do need to see the people that are in most urgent need, but certainly more funding should go into the NHS.
Absolutely. And I really saw that when I used to volunteer with Samaritans. I was a listening volunteer there. And it's such a brilliant service and I believe in it so much. But what was really on the up in the time I spent there was the amount of like random referrals we were getting. And Samaritans, it's not that kind of organisation. You contact them if you need help.
Yeah.
You don't need somebody else to send
your
details.
Who was referring people?
There'd be mental health charities that'd be struggling with resources where we were being given, people had like emailed in a state, and we were being given sometimes just a forwarded email of, oh, would you talk to this person?
So that's shocking.
It's horrific. Luckily, that was rare, but that was the most extreme stuff. It's difficult to kind of trace a lot of that, like what was their intention in doing it. But if certainly someone's gone for support that's more hands-on than Samaritans at the end of a phone, then how can that not be downgrading the support level?
Yeah.
If they've gone in for maybe face-to-face counselling in a charity, they don't have capacity, so they pass you on to something that's not face-to-face.
Yeah, and you're so sensitive when you feel this low and when you're this, I don't know, tortured in your own head. You're so sensitive to the slightest bit of judgment or anything. And feeling like everybody's got that fear of going to the doctors and feeling like, oh, you shouldn't be here. You're fine. Why are you wasting our time? Yet people have that fear about going when they want to get their breasts checked or whatever. Do you know what I mean? If they've got a lump in their, people always have this, oh, I don't want to take up their time if it's not serious.
And that's exacerbated by mental illness symptoms.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's it. And then it can feel like if you're already thinking that, you're convinced of it, you're looking for it to be validated. And so if you are then passed around of course you're going to come to the conclusion of they don't want to help me, or I'm not worthy of the support, or I'm not bad enough to deserve it.
Yeah.
Because that's seemingly how you're being treated.
I just find it really odd.
It is really confusing.
Yeah.
And when you're struggling to get through a day,
yeah,
and you can't even work out what kind of help you're being given.
Yeah.
That's just going to make things worse.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, I feel like I've just been really whingy and bitter.
No, it's fine, because it's honest. You know, there is so much that needs to change with our NHS. And I love the NHS enough to feel comfortable in criticising it, because I love what it stands for and what it can be at its best.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean there's not improvements, that it's vastly underfunded and disproportionately underfunded when it comes to mental health.
Yeah.
So there is so much that needs to change. You know, luckily there are loads of people out there that are working towards that change.
Yeah.
I feel I should finish up on what I mentioned from Samaritan, saying it wasn't passive when we received referrals that were inappropriate.
Mm.
Of course, Samaritans is going to reach out and support that person.
Yeah.
But they're still going to highlight, yeah, this is great, this is what we do. You still need the support from these other people that have referred you.
Yeah.
And we would be pushing back as much as possible to make sure people get the proper care.
Yeah.
So there is people working to make improvements. And
yeah,
we try and do our bit on the podcast in demystifying this stuff. And that's why experiences mm-hmm. like yours are so important. Because otherwise, unless someone you know well has gone through this, you're just not having any insight into what these processes are like.
Yeah.
And that can be something.
Yeah.
So people hopefully do feel more empowered
or
ask, what is this type of counselling that you've given me?
Yeah. Explain to me, please, the difference between these roles.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'm in a place to do this because this is gradually getting better by itself. But there are people who aren't strong enough to ask those questions.
Right, absolutely. And that's the thing that scares me the most when resources are stretched, is
yeah.
that decisions like that are having to be made that shouldn't ever be made.
Mm.
Yes, of course, as a counsellor, for example, you need to assess suicide level in those you deal with for your risk assessment and your safeguarding.
Mm.
But that shouldn't ever be the deciding factor on if someone gets help. Counselling is not exclusively for the suicidal. You don't have to be suicidal right now to benefit from something that arguably everyone could benefit from.
Mm.
But when things are stretched as they are so frequently,
yeah,
we're in these impossible situations.
Mm. Sorry, I feel like I've taken up loads of time.
No, it's fine. We'll try and bring the tone up a little bit as we start to round up, because not to invalidate what you've been through, but to me, at least, you're an icon in what you've got through. And you live a life now that when people are at their worst, they could never imagine. You know, when you're at your worst with your symptoms, you can't imagine leaving the house or leaving your bed.
Mm.
And yet you're out there performing and doing something that so many people would look up to. With what support you have been able to grab together and all that you've learnt yourself, you've got to a point where you are high functioning.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I always feel like I'm not high enough functioning, but yeah.
I think that's a symptom of being high functioning, to be honest. It's an ability to recognise, like, relativity.
Yeah, I suppose so. But yeah, that's nice of you, thank you.
Of course. And so, is there anything you would want to pass on if people are relating to what you've said, and they're really in it and struggling to get support or struggling to figure out what's happening in their mind?
I just think your thoughts aren't your identity. There's so many other things influencing your thoughts, and some of those are just literally your body and the symptoms that it's having. Sometimes when you feel anxious, your brain overworks and tries to find a reason for you to feel that anxiety, and it's just trying to find a reason for that feeling in your gut. It's not, your thoughts aren't who you are. They're just things that float through your mind, and you decide which ones of them are relevant and which ones aren't. So please don't feel like that you need to be defined by every intrusive thought that you have. That's what I wish somebody had told me, I think.
That's a brilliant point, because intrusive thoughts, when they're at their most scary, it's also that they're at their most extreme.
Yeah.
And you think things that you would realistically never actually do. You know, things that would put yourself or others in danger in all kinds of wacky ways, but that's what intrusive thoughts are like.
Yeah, it's just about...
But that doesn't change who you are because you have a bad thought. That doesn't make you a bad person.
No, especially because I started taking antidepressants for that reason. And it's amazing you get to sort of experience what I think normal feels like for most people, where you can have a thought that makes you anxious for a second, and then you go, okay, and you move on, and you don't feel rocked by it. So I think to have seen things from that side, and then occasionally when I get knocked and I can feel myself getting that kind of OCD anxious, you just realise how little it is about the thought in your head and how much it is about the anxiety. The thought, whatever it's attaching itself to, like, what if I'm evil? What if germs are going to kill me? You know, whatever it's attaching itself to is kind of irrelevant. What it is this desperate feeling of, I need to fix this now and I need to sort this out now and this is the end of the world. That is anxiety, and it's not, the thought it's attached to is irrelevant and it doesn't define you. That's, I guess, what I would say.
No, I love that. That's a really brilliant bit of insight.
Thanks.
So we'll wrap up there. If people want to learn more about you, where should they look online?
I am on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is at LateyLucas. That's LateyLucas. And then I've got a website, katelucascomedy.co.uk. And I'm on Facebook.
Brilliant. And do you have any tour dates coming up post-Fringe yet?
Not just yet. I'm going to kind of go over what I want to do after the Fringe once I've finished this hell. No, it's got fun bits, but it's stressful as hell.
Yeah, I think if you've not experienced the festival, it's a level of crowds and number of shows that it's hard to fathom.
Yeah.
3,500 shows.
Mm-hmm.
Is madness to look at. It's bad enough to see in the catalogue.
Yeah, I 100% agree.
All right, so we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances, and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.